Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How are you doing, Brian?
Well, Sean, I'm feeling that I'm Italian-American and proud of it. How about you?
Super as always, you know it.
Yes, I mean, we must be feeling especially super because we are at the end of a long and busy autumn. I suppose it's not quite the end, but we're nearly at the end of 1987.
Well, we are at the end of 1987.
Yeah, year before you were even born.
Yeah, and 2 years before I was even born.
And we've lived through it. That's right. Ladies and gents, this is the fifth and final episode of our 1987 Best Actress mini-series. We'll be talking about the last film nominated for Best Actress, and we will be revealing the results of our long-awaited re-balloting. But it's just been a busy few months. There's a lot to give thanks for, isn't there, Sean?
There is. It is Thanksgiving, and this episode is coming out.
Mm-hmm. What are you thankful for?
I am thankful for certain steps I have taken to have better mental health for the past year.
Very good.
I'm thankful to have a podcast with you.
Aww.
And I'm thankful that Broad Appeal Live was such a hit.
We assume
it hasn't happened yet.
Well, I mean, it has happened, but it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Meaning that we're recording this before it's happened, and barring any unforeseen disasters, you will eventually hear it at some point before Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you thankful for?
I'm thankful for you, as always, and the joy and love and, occasional argumentation that keeps me on my toes. I'm also thankful for a check on the authoritarian power of this president. I'm thankful that Barbara Streisand has released a new album, even if it's mediocre at best. And I'm thankful that we have a Best Actress lineup coming up in 2018 that looks like it will have a lot of middle-aged character actresses.
Yeah.
So there you go. I'm thankful for all those things.
I have to say, I was triggered when you said the word check because I thought you were referring to Anna again.
No. Okay. Well, so I'm also thankful that Magnificent Obsessions, the films of Ross Hunter at the Cinema Museum, has been such a success so far.
So far?
So far. And it's not over yet.
No, by the time this comes out, we will have four more films for you to see. Pillow Talk, Thoroughly Modern Millie, Madam X, and Airport.
Oh, amazing. I can't wait for Madam X.
Me too.
But I know that the screening of Imitation of Life and All I Desire and Magnificent Obsession have all been huge hits.
Oh my god, people were tearing my clothes off.
No, but honestly, and it's interesting that you're getting now down to Pillow Talk, because Rock Hudson, of course, is a famously closeted gay star of Hollywood. But isn't it right that Ross Hunter, as opposed to Rock Hudson, was very instrumental in kind of shaping the image and the persona and the career of Rock Hudson?
Absolutely.
Ross and Rock.
And you know, Douglas Sirk said that he thinks it was Ross Hunter who was fully responsible for turning Rock Hudson completely homosexual. He said...
That's a bit of a dubious opinion from a politically incorrect German straight man.
Well, you know, do you believe in the spectrum of sexuality, Brian?
Yeah, I do.
What are you on the Kinsey scale?
Oh, I'm off the charts.
You're a solid six, aren't you?
Yeah, probably.
I'm a five, I think.
Except for Juliette Binoche or somebody like that.
Yeah, someone with short hair.
Short, dark hair. Irene Jacob, Juliette Binoche, there we go. And the occasional redhead, Julianne. But no, seriously, the idea of Ross and Rock, an openly gay man shaping the career of a closeted gay man, is fascinating. And I'm sure that the remaining films in your series will be fascinating.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to all the research that I get to do along the way of this.
So look that up on the Cinema Museum website. But now, when the moon hits your eyes like a big pizza pie, it's 1987. Am I right?
Yeah, if you insist.
That's how this film begins. The film, as you all know, as you've all been waiting for, the film is called Moonstruck.
Do you think this is the film that most listeners have seen from this year?
I think a lot of people have probably seen Fatal Attraction, but I suspect more have seen Moonstruck. In fact, I think you and I have seen Moonstruck in particular special occasions. You certainly more than me. I discovered, Sean, that you know this movie by heart.
I know it inside out.
So we should say, I obviously, as has been frequently referenced, I take notes during the movie. But sometimes it's quite dark because we keep the room dark in order to watch the movie. And so sometimes my notes are sort of indecipherable. It often takes me a while to, like, figure out what I've written down. But as we were just going through the notes just now, I would say, like, a word, because I could, like, figure out one word from line, and Sean would instantaneously come with the entire line. So you know this movie, you know, it's like the Talmud to you.
Yeah, because that's a reference that really applies to my life, doesn't it?
Okay. Carry on.
Okay, this may be the film that I have seen more than any other in my life.
For real?
Possibly, yeah, because this is my mother's favourite film, and we always used to watch it whenever she kind of wanted it to be kind of cheered up or something. And not only that, I had the pleasure of using this film in one of my film studies modules when I was in university. And I've also watched it with other people as recently as August this year, and as most recently as the other night with you.
I know.
And it's referenced a lot. A lot of these lines from this film are referenced in my family dynamic.
Give us the top three.
Well, we have, who's dead? That's one of them.
Do you literally say that when someone in your family dies?
Well, we reference, like, whenever someone wakes you up. Whenever someone wakes you up earlier in the middle of the night or the phone rings, it's
like, you say, who's dead?
Who's dead? Yeah. That's also because, like, Sicilians are a bit like Irish people in some ways.
As well we know.
Yeah. What else do we do?
Anything to do with oatmeal?
No. Snap out of it, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, bring me the big knife. That's actually one we say a lot at home. Yeah.
So it's fair to say that Asia O'Hara would not fit in your family.
I'm putting together whatever reference you're trying to make. What are you trying to give
her
about?
Her disastrous performance as Moonstruck Ira Cher.
Oh, God.
On All-Stars 3.
No, it wasn't All-Stars.
Oh, sorry, season whatever it was.
I thought you were talking about Butterflies for something. I was like, what is he talking about?
No, Butterflies are free, though, Asia. They're free. Just talk to Eileen Heckert.
Butterflies are dead.
No, but seriously,
you know, I actually thought Asia's performance was charming in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
It just was bad.
Cher really is having a moment, though, right now. What with the ABBA album, with Mamma Mia 2, with the Cher show premiering on Broadway. I feel like a whole sort of millennial generation that maybe hasn't paid attention to Cher is suddenly realizing or thinking they realize that they love her.
Well, not me. I mean, I know. A millennial.
Yeah.
And she's been in my life ever since... Well, ever since Believe, really.
Sure, yes, but we've already frequently acknowledged that you're an old soul. You're hardly millennial to your core. But I think it's fair to say that
I am living proof.
You're closer to the truth. But I think it's fair to say that a lot of, like, twinky 20-somethings who probably have never seen Mask, they wouldn't know Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Jean, Jimmy Dean, if, you know, you stuck a sausage in their face.
Well, you haven't seen Mask.
I think I actually have
seen Mask. I watched it on a train.
Years ago. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, Cher is many things. She has many sides to herself. To her music career, to her tweets, to her political opinions, and even to her acting roles. There are a range of roles. She doesn't always do the same thing. And you are a true student of Cher.
Yeah.
Some of these new Johnny Come Lately to the Five and Dime fans, they sort of know one aspect of Cher, but you really know it all. And believe it or not, we've covered Cher a number of times on this podcast already.
Yeah, so, I mean, of course we did those trilogy episodes with Good, Bad, Crazy, but individually, we've done Tea with Mussolini,
mm-hmm.
We're now doing Moonstruck, and we have done
Mermaids.
Mermaids, yeah, that was in our very first season all those years ago.
So Cher is right up there with Meryl and Winona. There aren't that many other people that we've done kind of multiple times.
However, because Cher has a smaller filmography, in terms of ratio, we've probably done more of her film career than anybody else's.
It's true. It's true. The percentage of her film career that we've looked at is enormous.
Yeah. I can't wait till we do Stuck on You.
Is that the one with Chaz Palminteri?
No, that's... Faithful. Stuck on You is the one where she plays herself. It's one with
The Matt Farrelly Damon brothers.
Damon and Greg Kinnear are conjoined twins.
Now, I wasn't even aware that she was in a film with Chaz Palminteri. Was that her follow-up to Moonstruck?
No, her Vulture Moonstruck would have been mermaids and stuff, remember? And also, oh, yeah, she did. Wasn't there one with Liam Neeson called, like, Suspect or something?
Oh, God.
I think there might be. Cher plays, like, a police detective in one of them.
Wow. These are some deep cuts on Cher.
Yeah.
So, just quickly, my history on Moonstruck. I saw it long ago when I was a kid, but I think you know this story. Moonstruck, to me, while the film is all about passion and it's all about sexual desire and attraction kind of bursting forth, in my life, it has always been associated with sexual frustration.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know why?
Yeah, because of that Mormon boy.
Yes. So I have no idea if this boy listens to the podcast. That, ladies and gentlemen, no names will be revealed. Let's just call him Elder Price. No, I'm just kidding. But for a while, when I lived in New York, I did have a months-long relationship with a Mormon boy who seemed like he was really into me. I can remember his apartment really well.
Was he cute?
Yeah, he was really cute.
Did he live alone?
To be honest, he looked a little like you.
Well, I mean, that's not an insult.
Maybe this is... He used to wear green hoodies, which is what Sean is wearing right now. Where's my analyst? I'll telephone my analyst about it, but he said to see me Sunday, but by Sunday I'll be floating with the Hudson with the other garbage. Anyway.
My God, you need your own little podcast where you just go on and on by yourself. I don't even know what I'm doing here sometimes. Honestly.
Okay, back to the story.
You need Tony Randall to do this podcast with you.
Tony Randall?
Yeah. You need Tony...
The Odd Couple.
Yeah, you need Tony Randall and you need... what's the guy from the telethon? You know?
Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, you, Jerry Lewis, and Tony Randall should be doing a podcast together, okay? Instead of me.
Meaning, you think I talk a lot?
I'm saying you talk a lot, but you entertain yourself so much. And this better stay in the podcast.
Don't worry, he'll never listen to it, so he won't know. Okay, back to the story. So I used to be seeing this Mormon boy, and for whatever reason, he was, like, into me, but it would never quite get as far as you wanted it to get, if you know what I mean, you know, between the sheets. And his way...
Did you ever see his dick?
Yes, I saw it, and things may have occurred with it, Sean. He wasn't one of those Mormons who wears that special garment. Like, he wasn't a practicing Mormon. He was raised as a Mormon.
Okay.
So it wasn't anything to do with, like, Mormon repression. I don't know what it was. But for whatever reason, whatever it seemed to be getting to a certain level, he would divert attention by saying, let's put on Moonstruck. And we never finished the movie.
What a weird sublimation of sexual desire.
Well, is it, though? Because isn't the movie all about... Well, desire.
It's about desire that gets consummated, though.
Yeah, but what you kind of wanted with this boy was you just wanted to, like, throw up in the window and howl at the moon and, you know, be like Uncle whatever his name is in the movie.
Did he live alone?
He had a flatmate, but, like, that he wasn't in the same room with us.
You could say roommate. It's the American term.
Sure, yeah. This was a chapter in my life, you know. It's a long ago chapter, Sean. It's helped make me who I am. It's what I think about when I think about Moonstruck, which is funny. There's a few things that he always wanted to watch. It was Desperate Housewives, that places
Jeez,
it in time.
Jeez, God yeah. almighty.
Desperate Housewives, Project Runway.
Yeah, that's fine.
Desperate Housewives, cool. Project Runway, Moonstruck, and Ugly Betty. Actually.
Don't get me started on Desperate Housewives, but I am started just a little bit.
Alfre Woodard?
That show was one of the greatest letdowns of potential ever on television.
There you go. It was exactly like this relationship.
That Desperate Housewives should have been on HBO.
Okay.
Okay, and it should have had more TNA and swearing and blood and murder. It was terrible.
So what you wanted was a bigger release.
Way more.
But isn't that the whole theme of Moonstruck? It's like, don't repress yourself, don't suppress yourself. Express yourself, let it out. Passion. There's two things I love. I love women, and I love opera.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Isn't that what he says?
Well, I love you, and I love opera.
Okay. I love you, and I love opera. And of course, we're talking about Nicolas Cage.
Oh my God, in his sexiest role ever on screen.
Now, I know I've just told you you look like a former lover of mine, but I have to say, Sean, there's something about Nicolas Cage in this performance. Am I wrong when I say that I look a little bit like him?
We had a debate, okay? I'm not here to stroke your ego, muchacho.
Stroke something else.
Muchacho, okay?
No, but seriously.
Well, first of all, I'm the one who wears raggedy, sweaty vests around the house.
But when you wear them, they don't have that... luscious, you know,
excuse
Sicilian
me.
Chest
well,
hair.
What do you call this?
I call those a few threads.
Okay, this, I'm, like, listeners, I am exposing my breasts, okay?
I see them.
A la, unnecessarily, Sally Kirkland.
Yeah, and what I would say is, those are some lovely Irish threads, and mine is a delicious Sicilian rug, just like Nicolas Cage has. He also has that narrow waist that broadens as he goes up.
Just like me.
He's got kind of ears, you know? I think anyone looking at a photograph of you and me and comparing it to Nicolas Cage and Moonstruck would see who is the more likely comparison.
Okay, here's another question for you then.
Yes, go
who ahead. Looks more like Olympia Dukakis?
That I think we'll have to leave to an outside source. Where's PricewaterhouseCooper?
You could probably play every role in Moonstruck if you just tried hard enough.
Well, you know, to be honest, here's another connection. You know that Vincent Gardenia and I have once played the same role. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, but you're going to tell me.
Vincent Gardenia played Mr. Mushnick in the film of Little Shop of Horrors, and I played it in summer camp.
What, age 16?
Probably even younger. Mushnick and son. That was me.
Wait, was Mushnick a Jewish role?
Yeah, of course it was. All the roles I played in high school.
So Vincent Gardenia, like you, was also being typecast as a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
I think we should get former podcast guest Michael Shulman back on to play Seymour. I'm sure he has once played Seymour in a production of Little Shop of Horrors. And if he hasn't, he and I should do a duet on Mushnick and Son. What do you think?
Yeah,
you can be Audrey.
Yeah, that role I was born to play, darling.
Okay. So those are all my associations with Moonstruck. But this movie, it's really interesting that this was an Oscar film, right? It won actress and supporting actress. Cher won, Olympia Dukakis won.
And screenplay.
Yeah, and screenplay. But as I'm saying, it's rare for movies to win actress and supporting actress.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen a lot.
We thought about this. The last one we can think of is Holly Hunter and Anna Paquin for The Piano.
Yeah, we haven't done our fact-checking, but I'm sure.
We have done our fact-checking, but we're clever enough people. We can probably figure it out. I think that is the case. It's been split ever since.
Yeah, and I guess part of that reason is, as we've commented so often,
yeah, you can only have one woman in a film.
Yeah. Now, granted, Fatal Attraction also had a supporting actress nominee, Anne Archer.
And then, of course, there's been other examples like American Hustle is just the first thing off the top of my head. Silver Linings Playbook. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We'll probably have it again, actually, in a month or so.
With
Viola Davis in lead and Elizabeth Debicki in supporting.
And probably they're going to arrange the girls in The Favourite in some way that going that way. So it's great. We love it when more than one woman from a film is nominated. But I guess what I'm saying is Moonstruck, by gaining those two female acting awards and, of course, the screenplay award for John Patrick Shanley, that's a big Oscar haul in 1987, comparatively.
Oh, for sure. They're all highly weighted, those awards.
Yeah, and particularly in a year when The Last Emperor seemed to be a kind of juggernaut for, you know, kind of so many of the categories. Moonstruck was like the popular hit. But this is a kind of movie that rarely gets rewarded at the Oscars. You know, a kind of...
Well, it's a romantic comedy.
It's a straight-up, fluffy, romantic comedy.
Totally feel good.
Yeah. Populist, big hit.
Yeah, big cast.
It has no veneer or patina of, like, social relevance.
Patina, eh?
Yeah.
A carapace of anything, perhaps?
I would just even say that, like, there's no kind of contemporary relevance to Moonstruck. Like, it's arguable, in my mind, that it doesn't even take place in the real world. Like, it barely seems like it's taking place in 1987. If you told me it was set in the same year as Mermaids, or
West Side Story.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems to almost take place in a kind of fantasy, Italian, nostalgic past to a certain degree. And so...
Well, it's Brooklyn, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's just this, like, fantastical world where everything is operatic and characters are exaggerated.
Yeah, and also, can we talk about the size of that house the Cascarini family live in?
Mm-hmm.
First you were like, no, that can't be all of it. I'm like, no, but it is enormous.
Well, they have the two parents. They have Loretta and they have Granddad.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, like, in those Brooklyn brownstones, they were single family homes. Now a lot of them have been broken up into apartments, but they would have, you know, been homes. Like, in many ways, Moonstruck is a throwback.
Yeah.
So, now Sean, I know you often get on my case for being contrarian. I'm going to be a little bit contrarian about Moonstruck, but I don't want to lead with that, okay? So why don't you... We know you've seen this movie so many times. We know that it's your mother's favorite film. You can quote it, etc. What is so great about Moonstruck? Be particular.
I think it's an incredibly tight screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
I think, how long is the film? It's like under 2 hours?
Yeah, definitely. It's like an hour, 40 minutes, maybe.
Yeah. In that film, you have central characters and you have peripheral ones who all get their stories wrapped up. And you get some characters like John Mahoney who plop in, who are not central or barely peripheral, who are extended cameos, to be honest, and get their story and get their character arc. And it's very interesting that so many of these stories get to take place in this like little cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm.
The acting is fantastic. Nicolas Cage, I think, should have got an Oscar nomination for this. You could argue that he's a bit hammy, but his character is operatic, just like the whole lot of them. Interestingly, obviously, John Patrick Shanley is a playwright,
mm-hmm.
and this was never a play. This was only a screenplay. But this is a good example of a playwright who transitioned well into screen. He takes all the best parts of a play and takes all the necessary elements of telling a story on screen, and they coalesce wonderfully. You have like pivotal scenes, but rather pivotal locations: the Cascarini house, the Met, Johnny Camerari's apartment. All these places are very central.
The bakery.
They're all very separate and distinct and part of the storytelling.
It's surprising, actually, that Moonstruck's never been adapted to the stage or even to a musical. Surely someone must have thought of that.
Well, if they haven't, time to edit this part out of the podcast and keep it for yourself.
Well, but the rights would belong to John Patrick Shanley.
Yeah,
anyway, carry on.
I suppose he hasn't thought of it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Cher won this Oscar because it was a crowning achievement for years of being an entertainer, a singer, a comedian, and showing in the last number of years prior to this that she was more than capable of holding her own in the cinema and being a credible, bankable, and likable actress.
You know, Cher is a great example of transitioning from pop star into actress because she kind of builds that up gradually, mm-hmm. and working with really good people, right?
Exactly.
When your first few films are directed by Robert Altman, Mike Nichols, and Peter Bogdanovich, and you actually, before you win an Oscar, you already have won Best Actress at Cannes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
For an entirely different film.
And I think the thing about that that's so interesting, because those movies, I mean, I haven't seen Jimmy Dean, but like Mask and Silkwood and this, they are all different, so she's doing a lot of things, but there's no air of pretension around Cher. She's still in public appearances and her Oscar appearances and stuff. She never comes off as someone who's trying too hard.
Never has, never will.
Yeah, she just comes across as this natural charisma. Obviously, she's a confident singer, but she just has this kind of presence in front of the camera that really, really works.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I mean, do you think she's playing Cher in this film?
No, and maybe we'll get to that. But am I right that Witches of Eastwick was also this same year?
Yeah.
And was that movie also a big hit?
I don't think it was a runaway hit, but it was a successful film.
Yeah, so she had kind of big hits. I mean, this was clearly Cher's year. And maybe if Sally wasn't quite as delusional as she appears to be, she would have just realized, well, of course Cher is going to win. She's a much bigger star. The movie's a much bigger hit.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a role, even though it is a romantic comedy, it's a role that showcases her really well.
Yeah, and listen, you know, Moonstruck is one of those films. I mean, I think Olympia Dukakis wins her Oscar by her own volition, completely, and her own talent. But as you said, we were talking a little bit about Can You Ever Forgive Me recently,
mm-hmm.
and you made the astute point that people are going to be like, oh, you know what, I really like Melissa McCarthy. One, put this screener on, hun. And two, gosh, that Richard E. Grant guy, he was good too. Tick, tick, tick.
Yeah, when a movie, and I actually think, oddly, they're comparable films.
Even though they're very different, they are comparable,
It's very likely that Can You Ever Forgive Me is a Manhattan movie as much as this, Moonstruck, is a Brooklyn movie.
Yeah.
They both have a theatrical sensibility. They're full of quotable lines. They're really written. It's highly likely that Can You Ever Forgive Me will get a lead acting, a supporting acting, and a screenplay nomination, if
absolutely.
Not more.
Absolutely.
Right? And so, in some ways, they're movies that you feel like you've discovered, you have a personal connection to, and they just kind of make you feel good. Even though Can You Ever Forgive Me is as much about disappointment as Moonstruck is about kind of passion and
release. Belief in love.
Yeah, belief in love. Just to take up a few of the points you said about John Patrick Chanley and things, I agree with you wholeheartedly. It's an excellent screenplay. It feels so written in a good way, right?
Like written.
Written. Yes, like a letter. No, but it really does feel written in the sense that the lines feel like they've been really crafted. They're really quotable. Of course, the most quotable line is, snap out of it. And I think when someone plays a role that is iconic, they need one line, one moment that everyone can quote. And for Cher, that's snap out of it.
It is. It is.
For Diane Wiest in Bullets Over Broadway, it's
don't speak.
For Miranda Priestly, it's that's all. You know what I mean? Like, you just have that thing, and that cements all the other quotable lines and quotable moments are kind of distilled. So it's an excellent screenplay. You're right in its theatricality. I mean, the scene that really made me realize that is the ending of Moonstruck, where they're at the breakfast table in the house, and suddenly, like, every named character in the film, including the aunt and uncle, who are, you know, very, very peripheral characters, they end up all there, all around the same table, and all the plot lines kind of converge in this one extended scene where you really could imagine that playing out on stage.
Yeah, it's the curtain call. The lights go out, and then they come back on again, and they're all there ready to take a bow.
Exactly right.
Yeah. It really is... I can't think of other films like this that are both highly theatrical but also very contained in, as I said, a cinematic universe.
I would also say that when you're talking about the plot, subplot kind of thing, what I love about it is how you do have Loretta's story with the two men, Danny Aiello and Nicolas Cage. Then you have Vincent Gardenia, who is the father who's having an affair. That leads us into the mini and related storyline where Olympia Dukakis is feeling neglected and she sees John Mahoney's professor character. And then even down to the micro level where you have that lovely little scene between the aunt and the uncle and their relationship.
Yeah.
What's interesting is while all that may seem like we're toggling back and forth between all these relationships, they share a kind of common theme.
Share.
No, this is what I mean. I actually, in rewatching it, I was struck by how actually, it's not all Cher. The entire movie is not about Cher.
Exactly,
That's what I'm saying.
I know, I completely agree with you.
I know you were making a pun, but what I'm saying is the theme is love. It's the overwhelmingness of love.
Yeah, and also the complexity of love and the nonsensicality of love.
Yeah, it's about how love drives you wild, love drives you crazy.
Yeah.
And in the instance of Olympia Dukakis and Vincent Gardenia, the fact that he fears death, right, as she says, has driven the love, the familiar love that he has for his wife and homemaker, that kind of dies down, and he's seeking out what he considers to be that passion somewhere else, whereas the aunt and the uncle, they can find the passion together still in their marital bed. And so it operates on all those levels, but thematically it's all unified, even to the degree that the grandfather, who's kind of just a sketch comedy character who walks his dogs,
who barely has any discernible lines.
But the howling at the moon, the moon unites them all, right? They're all under the same moon.
They are.
Right?
Yeah,
like Fievel sang in An American Tale.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
There's one moon shining over them all, and that moon is making them behave crazily, making them behave in operatic ways. And so it's not just on the level of it being really quotable that it's a great screenplay. It's also just a kind of genius construction.
Well, if I was to change one thing about it, okay, in that final scene, when they're all together, the doorbell would have rang one more time, and it's the Blanche Devereaux character, who Vincent Gardini has been having an affair with. She comes in, and she just has a glass of Spumante with them.
I don't think that would have been particularly fair to Olympia Dukakis. Olympia Dukakis would not be happy. Maybe if John Mahoney had showed up, that would have been all right.
Oh, what if they showed up and they were like, oh, we met each other and we're in love.
Yeah, that would have been
good. And now we want to come and thank you. That's like That is like Shakespeare. Can you say that?
Yeah.
As in, it's shit.
Yeah.
Okay? It's
yeah.
a shit tying up a romantic
It's like the
love.
End of Measure for Measure
yeah.
or something.
There you go. There you go. I'm like Shakespeare.
Yes. Like, yes. Okay. There you go. Brilliant. The Bard of Brixton. So, much praise for the screenplay. Absolutely. And it was fascinating to rewatch it again. Here's where I get a little contrarian, okay? And I know we're going to talk about the performances. We're going to talk about Cher, Olympia Dukakis. Like, I understand that this movie is operating at a really high register, right? Like, you get that.
Yeah.
You get that from the beginning. And I absolutely have no problem with Nicolas Cage. Like, he is doing it over the top, and it's brilliant the way it's directed. Like, we meet him, and he's, like, shoveling the bread into the oven.
And he's sweating.
Yeah, but it's like,
the oven is
representing his passion,
yeah,
right?
It's a blue-hot flame.
Right, but of course, like, the thing is, he has this burning revenge, this burning passion. Danny Aiello, as the other brother, the one who's marrying Loretta, he is a big baby, he's a drip, he has no passion. He barely even remembers to get her an engagement ring or get down on one knee. So that kind of yin and yang dichotomy, the kind of hot and cold, I'm fine with that all being like over the top. And of course, it's going to get even more operatic as it goes on. You can't deny the pleasure that comes when Nicolas Cage just lifts Loretta up and takes her to his bed.
You should never deny pleasure.
Well, okay, there you go. Yeah, but like even like knocking over the table, like one of the other things that you gotta kind of love about this movie is the fact that it takes romantic comedy tropes. You bring together Loretta and Ronnie, and they have this kind of simmering passion, but it actually doesn't take that long. She goes over to his house, and rather than in a screenplay needing to construct like some way to contrive to get them to kiss, it's just literally like knock over the table, lift her up, and like bring her to the bed, because that is the kind of man that he is.
Yeah.
So it's kind of saying like, I don't need all this contrivance. Let's just get to what everyone's waiting for, which is for them to get it on, and then for her to be in trouble because she's caught between the two guys. You know what I mean? So while it's kind of like romantic comedy distilled in that way.
He made me look the wrong way, and I cut off my hand. He could make you look the wrong way. You could lose your whole head.
I'm looking where I have to become a bride.
A bride without a head.
A wolf without a foot. Wait a minute. What are you doing?
Son of a bitch!
Where are you taking me?
To the bed.
Oh, God. Okay, I don't care. Take me to the bed. I don't care about anything.
The fiance character is the one that you don't want her to end up with. The other one is the one that you do. And let's just get to it. Let's just get to the meat of it. Here's my problem, okay? I'm an Italian-American, Sean, okay?
Now you're an Irish-Italian-American.
I'm an Irish-Italian-American, it's true. As you know, I do make a lot of hand gestures. I have a lot of passion. I love to carry people to my bed and throw them down on it. As a Mormon boy can attest. But so what I'm saying is, how would you feel if we had a screening of The Quiet Man? Okay?
Interestingly,
or Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Interestingly, I watched The Quiet Man in the same module that I watched Moonstruck.
What is it about, like, ethnic stereotypes?
It's about aspects of ethnicity and what determines whiteness.
Well, okay, so there you go. So here's the thing. Moonstruck is a screenplay by a non-Italian.
Yeah, by an Irishman.
Directed by a non-Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Starring a cast that has a few Italians, but a number of Greeks and Armenians and Russians. Okay, and everyone is operating in this register that is the most stereotypical Italian there could possibly be. Okay? Now, I know that Italians, at least in this day and age, certainly in 1987, are not like what we would call a protected class. Like, you know, they're not an oppressed group. But I do have to say, there is a level of like reductiveness, okay, in these characterizations.
Look it up.
But you have to admit this here, because it's like, and you know what really got me at the end? After everything's been resolved, and then they're just like, the last line of the film is, to family, familia. I was just like, okay, I could have done without some of this. Some of this kind of organ grinder monkey level stereotyping.
Yeah, but babe, Irish people and Italian people are not a million miles apart, okay? John Patrick Shanley, I'm sure in some aspects, modeled that on his own family.
Yeah, he probably grew up, you know, knowing Italian families, wherever he was in the Bronx.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure. But I'm just saying that, like, it's funny because everything is played with such broad emotions, right? That, like, in the kind of broad emotions of Catholicism, like let's go to Sicily and let's see the grandmother dying,
yeah,
or the, you know, the mother dying, kind of dressed in widow's weeds in her bed. Like, let's be in the Italian restaurant and have a waiter who's literally named
Bobo. Okay,
you know what I mean?
Listen, I will give you that.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, it'd be one thing if this was like Francis Ford Coppola or somebody like having a bit of fun, like poking fun at their own nationality. There's a bit of it that like slightly rings false for me with like Dean Martin on the soundtrack and stuff, where you're just like, okay, like,
no.
Are you lathering it on like a bit too much marinara?
No, no way. Oh, come
no,
on.
You are
being contrarian.
I didn't expect to feel this, but I did slightly feel it. And it's interesting, like, in relation to the character of Loretta. Like, I know that by now, Cher is so associated with this role, and so associated with Snap Out of It, that it's kind of hard to, like, take a step back and even, like, think about her in this part. But she's never played an Italian before, as far as I know, has she? Before 1987.
No, I don't think so. I mean, she hasn't played many roles at all.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, like, She's laying on a bit of an Italian accent. And actually, I'd forgotten at the beginning that she doesn't have the big hair.
No, she doesn't. And she goes through a transformation.
Yeah, yeah. So,
And actually, that's what I really like about this film as well, is that after, when she's at the opera, you're like, oh, it's Cher.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
But tell us a bit about the character of Loretta.
Okay, so she's a woman in her late 30s.
37, in fact.
37, in fact.
Is she the same age as Alex Forrest in...
Mm-hmm.
Oh my god, 1987 was the year of being 37.
Oh, wait, was she 35 though, Alex Forrest? I think she was 37. Either way.
36 maybe? Around the same age.
Either way, same demographic. Loretta, unlike Alex, has been married before. Her husband died. And she claims that he died not only by getting hit by a bus, but he died because of bad luck. So they got married in a registry office. Her father didn't give her away. There was no honeymoon. There was none of that kind of stuff. She's married for 2 years. He's dead.
And so that's all about, I guess, the theme being they didn't go through the romantic gestures of love.
Also, you may notice that Loretta's name is Loretta Cascarini Clark, which gave me the impression that she married an Irishman.
Where does it say that?
It's when Johnny is proposing and he says, Loretta Cascarini Clark.
I really didn't notice that. It's interesting. So, does that mean she married what? Like an Irishman?
Irishman. But Clark is an Irish name. C-L-A-R-K-E.
Yeah. Interesting. And that's part of what I'm saying. Like, that whole thing about, like, bad luck and the curse and the superstition. Like, you know, I understand that there's laughs and there's things to be gotten out of, like, the scene where she goes to the airport and that woman's like, you see that plane? I put a curse on that plane. My sister's on that plane. It's gonna explode. And you're just like, okay.
50 years ago, she stole a man from me. Sorprese il mio uomo. Today she tells me that she never loved him. That she took him to be strong on me. Oh, she's gone back to Sicily. Ritorna in Sicilia. I cursed her. The Green Atlantic water, she'll swallow her up.
This is like Sophia Petrillo, like taken to like new heights.
Yeah, to demonic purposes. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's...
What about Cosmo's Cosmo's broad? Yeah, what is it? So basically, he gives her a charm bracelet that has birds and stars, and he says, "The birds, flight of the stars, I guess." And she says, Oh, Cosmo, you have such a head for knowing.
I know.
I mean, where is she from? What is she?
She's from a Damon Runyon short story is where she's from. Like, they sound like they're out of Guys and Dolls. And that's what I mean. Like, it could have been the 50s. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Actually, that woman wouldn't have been out of place in Manhattan Murder Mystery.
Back to Loretta. So, in a way, it's only struck me just now, but I had forgotten that at the beginning, Cher has a little Susan Sontagian streak of gray in her hair.
Not unlike myself, darling.
Yeah, and she's actually kind of done up in, like, frumpy cardigans and things. So it's a bit of a now Voyager story as well, isn't it?
Yes, she wakes up Loretta Crascarini and ends the film as Camille Beauchamp.
No, but I mean, she tosses her cares and curls away in the beauty spot, you know, just like Thoroughly Modern Millie. I mean, I'd forgotten there was like a whole makeover scene.
Yeah, which is just like Thoroughly Modern Millie.
And just like Now Voyager.
Yeah.
And it's basically like all those movies where we have to frump up our heroine in order to then
She didn't go to Betty Davis levels.
With the caterpillar
eyebrow.
But she does get her eyebrows plucked.
She does.
What does the beautician say to her?
She says things like, I have wanted to do this for 2 years. Or something like that.
Yeah, they've all been waiting.
You have made me so happy.
They've all been waiting for Loretta to kind of show off the fact that she is indeed a movie star. She is indeed Cher.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, as a character, do you think Loretta is an iconic character, and if so, why?
Well, she's an iconic character because she's a woman of a certain age,
mm-hmm.
who is independent and works. Can I just point out that actually we see her do her job in this film?
Yes, although not always well.
Love
distracts her and she leaves that cash lying around, or she doesn't deposit it in the bank.
But this is the thing, like, we know she has a job, we know that she's a woman who has lived a life, she's been married, she has a head for numbers. Like, it's a great role, okay? Uh-huh. And she's a woman who has assuredness and confidence. You know, she goes on her own little journey the same way we do with her. I think it's wonderful. It's charming. It's funny. She makes errors. She fixes things. She is both the audience and the protagonist.
It's interesting because, like, as I was watching the film, I was thinking, Olympia Dukakis is, in real life, not that much older than Cher.
6 or 9 years older.
Yeah, so not old enough to really be her mother. But it's striking that they both won the Oscar because they are definitely playing in a similar register at the start. Like, in a way, they both have this dry, kind of understated, sort of muted way that they speak. Like, in that scene where she's trying to get Danny Aiello to propose to her in a more romantic way at the Italian restaurant.
You know, I was married and that my husband died, but what you don't know is I think he and I had bad luck.
What do you mean?
Well, we got married at the City Hall, and I think it gave bad luck the whole marriage.
I don't understand.
Right from the start, we didn't do it right, okay? Could you kneel down?
On the floor?
Yeah, on the floor.
This is a good suit.
I know that. I helped you pick it out. It came with 2 pairs of pants. You know, Johnny, it's for luck. I mean, a man proposes marriage to a woman, he should kneel down.
She is tamping down whatever inner emotions are playing, and she's kind of doing it in this very flat kind of tone, like, you got to get down on one knee, you got to give me an engagement ring. And then I absolutely love the whole description of the oily fish.
Yeah.
Do you know that line?
Yeah, it's like he wants to have some kind of fish, and she's like, no, don't get that. That's an oily fish. You know, you're going to be halfway over the Atlantic. You're going to be greeny. Your palms will be sweaty.
She's like, you got to have something and give you a base in your stomach.
Yeah, and then at the airport, she's like, here, get you some gum. You know, you chew and make your ears open.
In a way, Loretta seems like she's
solid.
Slowly, but she's slowly sliding into being her mother.
Yeah.
Right? She's going to be a version of her mother.
She's going to be making the fried bread with the egg in the middle of it.
Yeah. And not that, you know, her mother, Olympia Dukakis, is a bad woman, but she's kind of a woman who's kind of settled for a certain thing. And then from the moment that Ronnie knocks over that table and takes her to bed, and what's the line about, like, I want you to make love to me
take out your rage on Johnny, on me. And she says, take everything from me until there's just the skin hanging over my bones.
I mean, that is passion.
That's straight out of... That's theatrical, though. That's yeah. It is... The film is not on a human register.
Right, right.
And that's fine.
It's like opera buffa, you know, and it really works. And with my caveats about the Italian-American stereotyping, I am happy to enjoy it. I'm happy to like it. But, like, do you actually relate to this movie? Like, do you feel that it touches a nerve in your soul?
Yeah, there were a couple of lines in this that, although amped up with the melodrama, actually kind of connected with me a little bit. Like, you know, we're here to love the wrong people and, you know, destroy ourselves. And
yeah, like love is not perfect is basically the message. It's messy and it's tempestuous and it hurts people.
It makes things a mess. We aren't here to make things perfect. The snowflakes are perfect. The stars are perfect. Not us. Not us. We are here to ruin ourselves and to break our hearts and love the wrong people and die. I mean that the storybooks are bullshit. Now I want you to come upstairs with me and get in my bed.
This is the thing about love films, is that when they depict, like, this triumphant love that unites people and brings souls together, I don't really have time for that kind of stuff.
Well, that's like the romantic drama.
Yeah.
Right? Romantic drama is all about kind of love fulfilling this longing.
Yeah.
Where, like, Moonstruck is more in the tradition of love makes you crazy.
Yeah,
right?
And love does make you crazy. You do love the wrong people.
Which is like in that kind of screwball, you know, bringing up baby type way, where love takes Cary Grant as the professor by the, you know, just steals his car and drives him to Connecticut and makes him run around in a bathrobe and kind of forget his own name. Like, it's that kind of love. It's very different, I would say, from even the sanitized rom-coms of the 90s and 2000s, the kind of Katherine Heigl type of rom-com. Like, this is... No, but what I'm saying, that's what rom-coms became when they got a bad name. And this is, like, the rom-com where people just are, like, howling at the moon and love is just making them behave in irrational, crazy ways. And we want to believe in that kind of love, right?
For sure.
Yeah?
And I do, in fact.
And Olympia Dukakis says, you know, at the start, she says to Loretta, "Do you love him?" And Loretta says, "I like him."
She says, no.
Right. That's what I mean.
She says, I like him a lot.
And Olympia says, well, that's good, because if you love them,
they'll drive you crazy.
They'll drive you crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so actually, Loretta chooses love with Ronnie over the kind of safe choice, which is Johnny.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, very often we choose the people who are wrong for us, or we love the people who are wrong for us, then realize that we should love the people who are right for us.
Yeah, and this movie is kind of praising those wrong choices.
Yeah, it is. It is, truly. I mean, do Ronnie and Loretta last?
Yeah, who knows?
Who knows? They actually, if we're really going by...
Do they start a podcast together?
Oh, stop it.
Maybe they start an...
Pirate radio.
An opera podcast.
An podcast, darling. Pirate radio.
Okay.
Come on. They're dead now.
They are not. Cher's not dead. No. She's very much alive. And so is Nicolas Cage, making wonderful film after film.
Yeah, but Ronnie and Loretta are dead.
What, did they die in an oven accident or something?
They left the gas on. They all burned. They all suffocated.
Yeah, while Puccini was playing in their ears. Actually, that's another connection between Fatal Attraction and Moonstruck.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the person who I actually had a huge newfound respect for in this film. Of course I remembered Cher's performance. Cher's performance is lovely on a rewatch for me. I have to say, while there are the big iconic moments, like when she goes to the Met and the fountain and, you know, snap out of it and slaps him and all that kind of stuff, for me it was more the quiet details that I really liked. There's this little gesture that she does at one point where there's a wine bottle or bottle of, you know, it has a little wrapper on the neck of the bottle, and while she's talking, she's just gently kind of like peeling the wrapper. I loved that about Cher. She is very, very comfortable in this role.
I completely agree with you.
That's the strength of this performance, is the comfort that she has in all the different modes that Loretta has to do, where she's just like handling objects. She feels really lived in this part. Like, it was tailor-made for her, and she kind of fits it like a glove, is, I guess, what I would say. The performance in the movie, however, that really moved me, that I really connected with, was Olympia Dukakis.
Of course, yeah.
As Rose.
Of course.
No, but I see, I remember watching this before. Maybe I was too young at the time to understand the sense of world weariness and disappointment that she has. But, like, not only was I laughing out loud when she says things like, "Do you want some oatmeal? You got a love bite on your neck. Cover
this,
that up.
This whole family's going down the toilet."
Are you drunk?
No. Are you drunk?
No. But I have a hangover.
Where's Pa?
Upstairs. Johnny Camareri showed up last night.
What? He's in Sicily.
No more, he's not.
No, he's with his dying mother in Sicily.
She recovered.
She was dying.
It was a miracle.
A miracle? This is modern times. They ain't supposed to be miracles no more.
I guess it ain't modern times in Sicily.
I honestly think Olympia Dukakis absolutely deserved this Best Supporting Actress. I mean, we didn't rewatch all the nominees, but certainly she's better than Ed Archer.
There we are. Same film, same year, same category, same year.
But honestly, to me, it's very poignant how her daughter, Loretta, is living out this fantasy of choosing the wrong person. And here she is, like, keeping the family going, still having this love of Vincent Gardenia. She doesn't get to slap Vincent Gardenia. She only pounds the table. She says, "Give her up, right? Give up your mistress." You know, I just felt such pain for her, where she's like, "He's gonna go listen to that Vicky Carr record all night, and then when he comes to bed, he's not gonna touch me." Like,
is it because you're getting older? Is that how you feel?
I mean, I'm also, you know, Dukakis is a name that I've had a long association with in my life as a boy from Massachusetts. Let's go, Michael. Disappointment. Not quite getting everything you wanted. Like, I just feel for that character. And she makes it funny and wise and sort of the still center of the movie. Like, everyone else is going crazy howling at the moon. And you just get this sense from her, this character of Rose, that Vincent Gardenia once did that for her when he was outside her window. And now he's just gotten tired of her, but she still has to make the eggs. And she still has to care for his father and his damn dogs.
Yeah. You give those dogs any more of my food, I'm going to kick you till you're dead.
Exactly right. And I also feel like that's also why the John Mahoney scene is so memorable.
Yeah.
That series of scenes. Because it's almost like a little one-act play.
Oh, right? Sure.
That he sees her a couple of times with his young women.
And, kiss my aspiration.
Yeah. And she just decides to, like, interject with him, have a conversation with him about why do you behave this way.
Yeah.
That woman was a student of yours?
Sheila?
Yeah, she was. Is. Was.
No saying, my mother told me. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Don't shit where you eat.
Okay, I'll remember that. What do you do?
I'm a housewife.
How come you're eating alone?
I'm not eating alone. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Why do men chase women?
Nerves?
I think it's because they fear death.
Isn't it amazing how there's so much space for these characters to have this in this film? Like, I know I mentioned the screenplay, it's such a testament to how good the story is.
But I think that's because even those threads there, you can sense when you see the whole thing about how they're thematically related. Because she's saying, why does a man cheat, right? That's the reason she talks to John Mahoney. But then she's faced with this choice, right? She's faced with this choice. He wants to have sex with her, and she decides not to.
Yeah, he wants a kiss, remember?
Yeah, but she says no. And then that's, you really feel for her because she's the one through the whole movie who never gets to, like,
she never gets what she wants.
She never gets that passion. Yeah. She never gets to let it out because her passion is for her husband.
Yeah, the only thing she gets is the reaffirmation of the marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah. The marriage, not the reaffirmation of her husband's affection.
But I felt for her in that moment where they're walking down the street, her and John Mahoney, and she sees the grandfather with the dogs.
Yeah.
And the grandfather gives her a look.
Yeah.
And it's that sense of, like, someone who's always made the right choice kind of feeling like, I've now stepped even half a step out of line, and I'm going to be shamed for it.
The last thing I'll say about this is the grandfather, he's aware of his son's own philanderings and poor positioning as the father of this family.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's also, we know he's critical by the look he gives Olympia of Rose.
Right, because he holds her to a different standard.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the best relationship in this whole movie is the aunt and the uncle.
Yeah, of course.
They have fun. They joke together.
They get laid.
They have their own business. They lay each other. And they, even after all these years of marriage, they're still passionate. That is who we should all aspire to
exactly.
be.
Exactly. Brian.
Yes.
The time has come.
Okay, so should we explain what we're talking about? So if you've just tuned in for Moonstruck.
Yeah, I don't know how.
We've spent the last couple of months watching all five of the Oscar-nominated Best Actress movies from 1987. You've heard what we've had to say about these different performances. Sean and I have decided to retabulate the votes. Of course, there's only two voters, me and Sean.
They're weighted, though.
But we have decided to do a preferential ballot where we have assigned points to the five nominated actresses. We are going to now take a moment to look at our own personal preferences and decide if we would award the Best Actress of 1987 to the same winner or to someone else.
Okay, I'm going to get the votes, you're going to tabulate them, and then I'm going to announce.
Okay.
Okay.
And ladies and gentlemen, you can wait with bated breath.
Yeah, just put a clip in here.
Okay.
It's a wonderful night for Oscar, Oscar, Oscar. Who will win?
So, Sean, now we've had a couple of months of election systems with all sorts of different procedures, you know, contested elections where people who were candidates were also counting the votes. I think we need to be utterly transparent here about how this happened, all right? We presented our ballots and we ranked them.
Yeah.
Yes. Our top choice got 5 points. Our least favorite choice got 1 point, and everyone in between. Now,
it's like an All Stars 3.
Because there's only two of us, one of us had to be the one who tabulated the votes. So I actually have tabulated the votes. I am the Brian Kemp of this podcast. Is that his name?
That's his name.
Oh, God. He's definitely my least favorite Brian.
Yeah.
There we go. So I am the Brian Kemp of this podcast, as well as being the Brian Mullen. So I have put the final results into an envelope, which is now in my hand.
Okay, so just for the listeners at home, the nominees are, once again, Cher in Moonstruck, Meryl Streep in Ironweed, Sally Kirkland in Anna, Holly Hunter in Broadcast News, and Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. May I have the envelope, please?
Point of information. In the actual Oscars, they just say the winner. Are you going to say the winner, or are you going to read them?
Oh, you have them in preference.
Yeah.
I want the winner first, okay?
Okay, well, I wrote them in that envelope in the, with their point totals.
Okay.
So you can see, you know, okay.
Where is it? There it is. I'm going to say who the winner is. Okay. And the winner is Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction!
Congratulations!
Oh,
Glenn, is this a premonition of something that is to come?
Oh my God!
Sean, did the results fall out the way you expected?
I thought there was going to be a tie. So I put Cher as number one.
I know you did.
And you put Glenn as number one.
Of course.
And by the way the votes worked out, because I put Glenn as number two.
I did not put Cher as number two, I'm sorry.
You put Meryl. No, wait. Who did you put as number two?
Holly Hunter.
Oh my God, Brian.
Do you want me to explain myself?
Well, you're going to anyway, so go ahead.
So, ladies and gentlemen, of course, in any election where there's just two voters, I mean, things can swing wildly. I think that's what Sean failed to take into account.
No, I didn't vote strategically. I voted with my heart and my
hunches.
I didn't
vote strategically. I voted with my heart as well, and I thought to myself, it is very hard, actually. Even Meryl, who only received... We both put Meryl last.
Yeah.
I still contend that Meryl is technically excellent in the bits of Ironweed that I did watch, mm-hmm. right? All of the bits of Meryl in Ironweed that I watch are technically very impressive. But let's be honest, we know Meryl can be technically impressive. We know she can sing. We know she can do pathos. It's very self-contained. So I ultimately decided I had to put her last. Sally Kirkland is very compelling. She's an amazing screen presence. But to me, like, that character makes no sense. It's just such an oddity that there's no way I could have ranked Sally Kirkland above the other three. So then it came down to Glenn, Cher, and Holly. And I have to say, as I thought about it more, I just said to myself, do you know what? Holly Hunter in Broadcast News, I feel that character more. I feel that character more than Loretta in Moonstruck. I don't know what to say. Like, I'm not saying I begrudge Cher her Oscar, but if I was voting, Holly Hunter in Broadcast News is me, kind of caught between her head and her work and her desires. I feel like she takes you through the gamut of emotions, like her girlish excitement when William Hurt, takes a shine to her, her suppressed kind of desires and all the conflicting issues with Albert Brooks and all that. So I really liked Holly Hunter in Broadcast News, but I fundamentally was blown away by Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. And this was not the reaction that I expected to have. As anyone who listened to that episode can attest, I found Fatal Attraction to be a nearly reprehensible movie. But Glenn Close takes a role that I honestly think almost no one could have done. And she plays every single note of that character to the utmost degree and makes her to be the most watchable, the most compelling, the most frightening, the most sympathetic psychopathic villain possibly I've ever seen. To take a movie where she is meant to be a kind of demon risen from hell and turn me to feel like she is a rounded, interesting, complex, sad, wounded human being, it is an extraordinary performance, and there was no way that I could not put that first. Degree of difficulty alone, Glenn Close, you will not be ignored.
Okay, pass me my card.
Yep.
Okay, I'm not going to give such a long explanation as you.
Never.
No, because I always can say exactly what I want in fewer words. Okay, so I gave what my first position was Cher. Like, for the same reason the Oscars voters gave it to her.
Which is what?
Which is brilliance, great esteem, a reward, and just like, you are wonderful.
So did you decide that before we even watched the movie?
No, I think I decided this order yesterday, and I reconfirmed it this morning.
Okay.
And you may notice, I gave Glenn Close second place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we had quite contentious conversations about this film. There was no doubting how good she was, for all the long reasons you
Why
just gave.
Why is Cher better?
I think it's a better film and a better performance.
Best Actress is not an award for the film.
I think it's a better performance and a better film.
Why is it a better performance?
Because it's her film. Fatal Attraction was supposed to be Michael Douglas's film. I want a female-driven film and not a villainous. I think this is just how I voted, okay? Number three, Sally Kirkland.
Wow.
Yeah, because even though Anna is a complete bonkers, batshit box of buggering bats...
Bollocks.
I have to say I was very compelled every time she was on screen.
Mm-hmm.
I was. There's no doubt about it. And just because it's so bizarre. So bizarre. And I love her narrative and I love her story. People vote for however way they want, okay?
I know.
And that's why I gave Sally...
I'm a rational actor. You're more of a... You vote with your heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
What?
And,
it's true.
Holly Hunter. I didn't care for that character as much. I agree with you. We're in agreement with Meryl. I thought Meryl was technically very good. I just didn't like the film or the character. And I felt her role was not substantial enough.
Okay, so, I mean, I suspect most listeners who've listened to all 59 of our episodes would have predicted this result, right? Like, it's no surprise that you would put Cher and Sally Kirkland higher than Holly Hunter.
I also spelled Meryl wrong, you may notice. Did you notice that? Meryl.
M-E-R-O-L.
Yeah.
It's like a Pepto-Bismol
Pass me that
substitute.
Pen. I want to correct it for when we tweet these pictures.
But it's really no surprise, is it, Sean, that a kind of type A news producer, Holly Hunter, I would respond to more than a kind of crazy Czech actress jumping up and down on one leg, right? That really is, that sums us up. And of course I would vote for a psychopathic, sexually obsessed career woman most of all.
Okay, tell me the truth, though. Did you think I would put Sally Kirkland higher or lower than number three?
Sally Kirkland for you was the wild card, because you have such enthusiasm for Sally Kirkland even before seeing the movie that I wouldn't have been surprised if you had put her at number one. But I think the movie itself was too weird for even you, with your irrationality, to make that decision.
Are you surprised I put Glenn as number two?
No, because I think I actually... That was an example of kind of serious campaigning on my part where, you know, I think for weeks and weeks I have been, you know, laying the groundwork for you to appreciate Glenn. So I'm glad that I had an influence on your vote.
Good.
Yeah.
Brian... So
I have a question, Sean. I have two questions.
All right, I was trying to wrap this up immediately, but here they come. Here come the questions.
Number one, in a previous episode, you said that you would have liked to see Sally Kirkland's performance in Fatal Attraction. And I actually think she's the one of these other five women who might be able to pull off Alex Forrest. Is there any other role swap that you would like to see?
Amongst these five people?
Mm.
I
wouldn't be against seeing Cher in Broadcast News. I kind of like the idea of her being paired against Albert Brooks and William Hurt. Cher and William Hurt is a really interesting
pairing.
That
is, yeah. But Cher and Albert Brooks, no.
Okay. How about Meryl in Moonstruck doing a kind of...
Polish or something.
No, like a proto version of Francesca Johnson.
Oh, because you think she'd be Italian?
Yeah, she'd be somewhere between...
No.
So her one John Patrick Shanley outing is enough for her?
Okay. No, the only switcheroo I would be happy to see is Sally as Alex Forrest.
Glenn in Moonstruck?
No.
Glenn in Broadcast News?
Glenn in Anna, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, those two easily switch, yeah.
Can Glenn do accents?
She did Albert Nobbs.
That was basically an English accent, because she wasn't even Irish.
That's an accent, though.
Yeah.
Is it not?
Isn't Cruella De Vil English as well?
Yeah.
Okay, so Sean's up for a Glenn and Sally swap-a-roo, but nothing else. Okay, and my last question is, are you glad that we did this 1987 deep dive?
I'm very glad. I think it was my idea.
It was,
yeah.
As all ideas are,
yeah.
It was yours.
But like all things I suggest, I'm also glad it's over.
What have you learned?
Interesting year. I would do this format again at some point, not immediately, but I would do it again.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, have you learned anything about these women? Have you learned anything about Oscars? Have you learned anything about the 1980s?
I've learned a lot about the climate at the time. I mean, Cher and Glenn Close. I mean, I don't know how old Glenn Close was. Was she really 37 in 1987?
Approximately. I'm sure she was.
It is nice that none of these women are ingenues. Not even Holly Hunter.
Yeah, Holly Hunter, I think, is technically an ingenue.
Borderline. Mm-hmm. Borderline. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we're shaping up for the last few years with Best Actress. We have had more middle-aged nominees, more kind of traditional character actresses. If we get Glenn and we get Olivia Colman and we get
Viola Davis
possibly.
And Melissa McCarthy,
I suppose. Melissa McCarthy would be an extraordinary nomination. And I'm even down for Gaga. I mean, I think Gaga really naturally inhabits Star is Born. Again, it's tailor-made for her, but she fits it like a glove. So, and there may be someone else slips in there that we don't expect, but I think it's going to be another good lineup. So you do this again, but not right away.
Yeah.
It's Thanksgiving. Christmas is just around the corner. We've got two special fun episodes that are going to be coming up for your holiday treats. One will be Broad Appeal Live, coming at some point, and another will be a special deeper look into the films of Ross Hunter, where I'm going to pick Sean's brains as a film programmer a little bit. So if you haven't seen any of Ross Hunter's collaborations with Douglas Sirk, definitely do watch those. If you've never seen Thoroughly Modern Millie, what are you waiting for? Put it on right now. It's the perfect Thanksgiving movie. I mean, White Slavery is absolutely right to watch on a day that's about Native American genocide.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. This has been the end of 1987, and we never once had to say the words, The Lost Emperor.
I'm pretty sure you said that several times.
I know I did. Okay. You can follow us at Broad Appeal Pod. I am at VA Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X. Apart from those two episodes, this is kind of the end of the year of Broad Appeal.
Yeah, but we're bringing you two Christmas puddings, so it's double dessert that you should really enjoy.
Okay, well, take some time to digest first.
Don't forget to subscribe, leave us a rating or a review.
Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your lovers.
And please, snap out of it!
Okay, bye-bye.